Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are having a slight experiment. We are having a one-half podcast. There will not be a second half of the podcast. There will instead be a bumper first half in which we're going to be talking about all the things that were in last time's magazine, the things that have happened since the last issue of the magazine, the things that have happened based on the last issue of the magazine. Joined by almost everyone who works at the magazine for this issue, we've got Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen, Jane McKenzie, and Ian Hislop. And so I thought it might be fun to start off, Jane, first with Rack, the Concrete. That was on the cover of the magazine, and you were on page 94 talking about it about four issues ago, saying, why isn't anyone paying attention to this? And since then, there has been quite a lot of attention paid to it.
Yes, absolutely. It seems to have taken a lot of people by surprise in the world of education, which it shouldn't if they, for instance, read Private Eye or read Health and Safety Executive's warnings or the Department for Education's own risk register. There was quite a lot of kind of warning for them about this for several years. So it shouldn't have taken them quite so much by surprise as it seems to have.
Can I ask a very basic question, which was, I remember you relating that story to me a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and I remember saying, that sounds bad, Jane. Like, that sounds really, but like roofs falling down on children seems like exactly what we did not want to happen. Why do you think people did ignore it? Did they just assume that they hadn't collapsed yet, so they were going to carry on not collapsing, and then suddenly, what changed?
Apparently more things have fallen down in the interim, which is why the sort of urgency has increased. I mean, given that it's over a year since they were rating the risk as very likely that a roof was going to fall onto children, and before that, the risk was rated as likely. So it's, you know, they have had quite a lot of foreknowledge of this problem.
I'd like to work towards a world when the risk of schools collapsing on children is rated low. That's a future we can all dream about, I think.
Is there anything in the government's line that, oh, it's all local education authorities who are responsible for this and local councils, and actually it's them who should have done all of this work and really nothing to do with us?
Well, as the Department for Education should know very well, it's responsible for the school estate on a sort of the grand rebuilding scale is their responsibility. Now, local authorities is certainly helpful if they know which of their schools are in the worst condition. For instance, when they're bidding for money from the Department of Education to do work. So, yes, I mean, so, to some extent, it would have been better if local authorities had already known where the problems were.
So do you think the Secretary of State for Education has got a point in saying that we could have said what a good job she'd done?
No.
To be fair, she was correct that a lot of other people had sat on their asses. That bit, I think we can all probably agree that they had.
A lot of the people had sat in her chair as well in the previous year, because she's the fifth education secretary in a year. So it's not surprising no one has. In 2 years, sorry. There's been a lot of churn, hasn't there?
There has. But it's not like education is the only sector that's affected by this. For instance, there's lots of police stations that were built in the 50s to the 80s that are affected by this. When the health and safety report came out in 2018 saying, you need to look at this, buildings are going to start failing with minimal warning, Devon and Cornwall Police went, right, we better shut Barnstable Police Station then and build a new one. They just acted straight away on it.
Got a police response time. That is fantastic.
But can you give me some idea of the other kinds of buildings to be affected? So I saw that the Royal and Dungate Theatre in Northampton has shut while they do a survey to check. I know that there was some very strange line about some hospitals' first floors closing because they were worried about obese patients walking on it, which I just thought any type of patients of sufficient numbers would have been the same problem. But this stuff is sort of everywhere, or is it? Or is it limited to a certain type of building or building time, you know, period of building?
Period of building, yes. If it was built between the 50s and I think 1982 is probably the latest that it's in public buildings. It was a popular building material at the time. It was lightweight, so you could use it for ceilings a lot.
Even the engineers at the time said this has a limited life. And presumably everyone ever since has said, but it must go on a bit longer than that.
In the early days of it going in, they didn't know how limited a life. I mean, sort of concrete on the reinforced concrete on the whole has been found to have a fairly short life. We've had, you know, car parks with concrete cancer. It's a different thing than the lightweight, crumbly concrete. But they have found that the life of concrete in those contexts isn't very long. Now, we still have Roman concrete buildings. Concrete doesn't automatically fail after 30 years, but those don't have rebar in.
Hang on a minute. The Romans had concrete?
The Romans had concrete.
It's really good stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry, Andy. I don't know about Roman concrete. What kind of dunce am I? Did they have little mixers, but they had to do them by hand or with horses or oxen?
But the secrets of Roman concrete weren't known until quite recently. It was quite impressive.
It's a great book. The secrets of Roman
just concrete. So we don't get accused of euphemism. They did have mixers, but they were called slaves.
yes. Okay.
It is weird that kind of short-termist thinking of thinking, well, this is lightweight, therefore it'll make a cracking ceiling, forgetting that maybe some buildings also might need to use that ceiling as a floor if they're more than a bungalow. So
I think it's worth remembering what a building shortage there was in 1950. A lot of buildings had been destroyed, and there was a baby boom of children coming through, requiring a lot of new primary schools. So to some extent, this was like putting... Oh dear, this is going to cause the man from Porter Cabin to write in. putting porter cabins in for temporary accommodation, which are still there 20, 30 years later. But instead, they were building cheap, lightweight concrete buildings, which are still there 50, 60 years later.
Mm. Should we have a brief digression about the man from Porter Cabin? Because there is one man, every time you use the word porter cabin or portaloo, you'll get a letter saying, what you've described isn't a porter cabin, that's a proprietary term. You're describing a temporary lavatory structure, or that's the generic term.
His name is Dick Ellershaw, and somewhere in Britain, a large red alarm is going off right now, and Dick Ellershaw is springing into action to fire off a letter to us. Yeah, we got one ages ago when I described something as a porter cabin, and your very, very mature solution to this, Ian, was to run his letter under the headline, "What a pathetic way to make a living," and to run every other letter in the issue under the headline, "Porter cabin."
Well, that is pathetic.
No, I disapprove heartily of that.
Can I quickly ask about the finance as well? Because there were lots of conflicting figures being chucked around about how much had been allocated to this or not. And someone said Rishi Sunak has only allocated, he's only allocated enough money to do 50 schools. And then he popped up saying, no, I've allocated enough money for 50 schools a year, and that's great. And that's completely in line. So, but I looked at your last report on it, Jane, which was in March. And even then, you'd noted that 400 million quid had been cut from the budget in a really sneaky, small print line of the budget for refurbishment.
Yes, we spend a lot less on school refurbishment than we did 13 years ago, which is there was the Building Schools for the Future plan. And that was a plan to replenish the buildings across the country that were already, at that point, sort of not in the best shape. Now, one of the reasons that capital spending fell was that building schools for the future was a really inefficient way of spending money. So they were sort of overspending for what they were getting. So when Labour says, we were spending millions and millions and millions on new school buildings, while that is true, to some extent they were not really getting their money's worth because of the way it was done to a private finance initiative. So lots of consultants and architects were getting a lot of money.
Is there a suggestion, Jane, that PFI is in some way not the most efficient way to conduct public business?
Yeah, lots of sort of middle people were walking away with all the money for new school buildings.
It's shocking, isn't
it?
Unfortunately, when it was got rid of, it wasn't replaced with a way of spending money to replace schools efficiently with, well-built buildings where the money was being spent on the school. It was spent on things like setting up free schools in the wrong place so that they weren't where there was actually pupil demand for a school, or competing with an existing school that had a useful building. The money that has been spent on school buildings has been spent poorly.
It was also a classic example of the fact that lots of people had been depending on their schools finally getting renewed, and then they were cancelled at the last minute because the money was diverted elsewhere, right? In the same way that the other crazy story that I read this week is there's a very small stretch of the A1 in Northumberland that it's taken something like 19 years of consultation about extending it, and they've just kicked it down the road further. And the same thing was happening. People have been waiting and waiting and waiting for this Building Schools for the Future money. And then just as they were about to get it, it was snatched away again.
Yeah, and that leaves them sort of unable to plan for a 30-year cycle of needing a new school building if the funding doesn't come after 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is one of the kind of classic things that you were saying about education secretaries come and go. But people in the real world have to plan in decade-long instalments of stuff. Yeah. They won't be moved on to be, you know, have a go at being defence secretary in 6 months' time.
We come on to a really important political comeback now, and someone who actually didn't last 25 or 30 years, exactly as you're saying, Helen, Big Liz Truss. She's back. She's better than ever. She's got a book.
And I know Adam is a Truss denialist and that he refuses to believe that she's real.
It rings a bell. Was she on telly, Strictly Come Dancing or something? I can't remember.
But yeah, it now has now been just over a year since her glorious, if somewhat brief, reign. And the thing that amuses me is that Anthony Seldon, as previously discussed on this podcast, decided she didn't merit a whole book as a prime minister. She's going to be a sort of long epilogue. She appears to have come to the same conclusion because she's not writing a political memoir. The book is called 10 Years to Save the West.
Okay.
Are you in, Andy? Are you excited? Do you want to know about...
If I can do it at the weekends, yeah, sure. Okay. I'll help.
There's a bit of a clue into what it's going to be, which is it's being published in Britain by Biteback, which, as we previously discussed, pays small advances. In the US, it's being published by Regnery, which is the big conservative imprint that publishes all the big Republicans. And so she came out, one of the things she said in her Mail on Sunday interview, she was asked about what she wanted. She said, I want a Republican to win the White House.
Right.
So Big Liz has decided that the UK is simply too small for the scope of her engagements, and I think she plans to make all her money in the future in the kind of American conservative circuit.
This is kind of a career move, isn't it? Because Nigel Farage has just signed up for big money with the Daily Express, but not the Daily Express in Britain, but their new US website. And it's to report specifically on US politics, because, of course, he's matey with Trump and Bannon and all of those, all of that kind of gang. So there is this kind of second career that people have where they go across the Atlantic and become kind of commentators on, and where people don't quite remember the success or otherwise of their political careers over here. I mean, it's brave to go in with a title like 10 Years to Save the World when the main thing that everyone remembers about Liz Truss, even me, was that she only lasted 44 days, isn't it?
44 days to tank Britain was the...
The Lady Jane Grey of politics.
I noticed, I read this morning that she'd weighed in on the cultural wars, and she'd said that she was against gender identification, and I couldn't help thinking, well, she identified as Mrs. Thatcher very, very strongly, and she expected us to believe this.
The thing that's mad is that she, as you say, the rehab attempt has already started. So Andrew Pearce wrote a magnificently bonkers piece in the Mail about how actually it was all the fault of people for not believing enough, and it was the blob that had taken... It was the blob.
Yeah, big comeback for the blob.
Because I don't know if you've noticed, but we've actually been living in an extremely left-wing country for some time, and poor old plucky Liz was the only conservative.
The fault of people for not believing it. Does he grow muddled up with Tinkerbell?
Exactly. You have to clap your hands if you remember Liz Truss existed, Adam.
Yeah. I seem to remember that Liz was slightly sort of detonated by the markets, which we're known. I mean, most of the sort of the hedge funders and private equity people I know are screaming left-wing public service lunatics.
Yeah, she was brought down by the Office of Budget Responsibility, which eventually delivered a very harsh critique of the mini-budget. That was made independent by George Osborne, so a nest of pinkos over there. The IMF, which spent the 2010s imposing austerity on every country and telling them they couldn't do any left-wing economic policies, also apparently all the cover for their secret socialism. And yeah, and the bond markets, also, again, raving communists to a man. It's a kind of an incredible sort of real conservatism has never been tried. And I, for one, am looking forward to the book on that basis.
The Republican thing is an interesting one, though, because I think I saw Ian Birrell, who's a good hack and he writes a lot about Ukraine, pointing out that if she wants a Republican in the White House, she wants someone who will probably slash support to Ukraine dramatically.
Yeah, so obviously Donald Trump is very dovish on Ukraine because he's got a bit of a man crush on Vladimir Putin.
Lots of them are, yeah.
Ron DeSantis, when asked by Tucker Carlson, said, I'm not really sure about committing America to this war, and then sort of had to roll it back because the Republican establishment is quite in favour of the kind of continued commitment. Vivek Ramaswamy, who is the one everyone got very excited about in the debates as a Republican contender, just thinks he thinks you should do a deal with Putin where you agree to give Putin the Donbass and the Crimea and all that stuff in exchange for the Chinese Russian military alliance ending. Like, what's step two of this? Like, one, give them Ukraine, two, you know, (3) world peace. I think that's the thing. That it's a very odd thing for a kind of someone who's quite
hawkish.
This to want a Republican when the gravity of the populist bit of that party. But that's her populism coming out, right? The populist Republican
thing.
You've
been talking about her for nearly as long as she was prime minister. I mean, I hate to be a party pooper here, but God.
I think it's the absolute best news for those of us who don't want a Republican, certainly don't want Donald Trump as the next US president, that if Liz Truss is throwing her might behind him, then phew, we might be all right. You never know.
The other thing I found out from James Heal, who wrote the sad biography of her that was going to be the rise of Liz Truss and then had to become the rise and fall of Liz Truss by the time it came out, was that her chief of staff walked into Downing Street and said that they were hashtag GSD, hashtag get shit done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, is that sort of like, it feels very...
I thought GSD were hair straighteners.
It's GHD. You
sure they weren't just talking about that? I'm sorry. Right, okay.
And get shit done is the motto of the British Water Company.
Okay, we should move on now to a so farewell then. So farewell then, Mohamed Fayed, late lamented...
I wouldn't go that far.
No, all right, late. Phony Pharaoh. Yeah, that's the other. Yeah, who's joined the 94 Club?
He hasn't. In a died final age 94
tribute, I believe had a bit of form with Private Eye.
He was one of the many billionaires or self-proclaimed billionaires that the Eye has had run-ins with over the years. Yeah, we tended to pick one for every decade, didn't we? And so we went in with Jimmy Goldsmith in the 70s, who tried to put us out of business. In the 80s, it was Robert Maxwell who sued us the way. Fayed, I don't think ever did Fayed ever take legal action against us?
No. He was mad, but he wasn't that mad. certainly I enjoyed greatly the legal actions that Fayed took. There was a fabulous court case, Court 13. It was a libel action between Tory MP and his wife, Neil and...
Christine Hamilton,
against Fayed. And it was one of those wonderful court cases where you just don't care who wins. It was merely the pleasure of it. And this was after Fayed had been giving brown envelopes full of cash to Tory MPs to ask questions in the Commons. So he didn't have a great reputation to defend, even in the libel court. But it was wonderful because Fayed was fantastically foul-mouthed. And he literally just said, fugging, fugging, fug all the time. And he said it in the witness box. And the judge kept saying, could you restrain your language? And I watched him a couple of times and Fayed said, absolutely, Your Honour. And then the third time he was asked, he referred to the Duke of Edinburgh as a fugging shirt lifter, which, again, is quite tough for open court.
Wow.
He was completely out of control. And if you read the obituaries and the warm tributes to Fayed, it was nuts. People do deliberately misremember.
What really struck me was what, given all of that, and given what a thug and a foul-mouthed man he was, and you know, very, very dodgy right the way through with, you know, his business career, getting involved with all sorts of dodgy people. I mean, Papa Doc Duvalier and Tiny Rowland. I mean, it was just literally every sort of dodgy figure you could possibly get. And in many cases, Fayed swindling them all along the way and taking their
and
money.
You've got to be pretty good to swindle that lot.
I mean, he was good at it. I'm not saying he's not good at it.
Credit where due.
But the PR job that was done on his behalf, right through to his death, as you said, with all those flattering obituaries, was just extraordinary. And what really struck me was that, you know, the brown envelopes affair, he kind of managed to present himself successfully, and a lot of the press went along with it, as this kind of man who had exposed the corruption of the British Parliament. And just glossing over the fact that it was him that was doing the corrupting in the first place, it was him that had offered all of these MPs money.
So just to clarify, he was this part of his very long campaign to get a British passport, or was that unrelated to that? Because he was giving... brown envelopes full of cash to...
It was an effort to get a British passport, and it was also to have the findings of a DTI inquiry into his takeover of Harrods, or House of Fraser, which was the department store chain that Harrods was then a part of, which he took over in the 1980s. And Tiny Rowland, his great rival in that, managed to get this DTI report put through, which memorably the DTI inspectors concluded that Mohamed Fayed had created a world where lies were the truth and the truth was a lie. And that was essentially what he went through. I mean, he was one of those people who just maintained that whatever was coming out of his mouth at any given time, however contradictory it was to whatever he had said before, was simply the truth, and that anyone who went against him on that had their own agenda which they were using against him. But it was absolutely the brazenness of it. One thing I went back and had a look at this week was a piece that I wrote in 2007, just ahead of the inquest, finally opening into the deaths of his son Dodi and Princess Diana in that car crash in Paris. So 10 full years had passed at that point. And again, this is the PR campaign. That was all presented and kind of lapped up as the media as being the establishment are against me, they're trying to stop the truth coming out. I had a quick look back at this piece of... six different legal appeals Fayyad had launched by this point, six judicial reviews or threats of judicial reviews, one civil action to delay things in the French courts, and two petitions to the European Court of Human Rights, all to basically delay all of that coming out, all the while presenting it as the establishment trying to stop the truth coming out. Now, this had the amazing and I'm sure entirely coincidental ramification that it meant that the inquest didn't happen until a decade after the deaths, which was past the French statute for criminal liability, so that no one could then be prosecuted for what then the inquest found out, which is what anyone who was quite sensible had known all along, which was that the security team employed by the Fayyads had put Princess Diana and Dodi in a car with a drunk driver, which had then been driven off at great speed through Paris.
The way people are going to remember him is as the chap in The Crown. That's going to take over the public perception. Oh, he was that man who treated his butler very nicely.
Oh, no. Okay.
This, again, is the problem. My own personal memory, my greatest memory of Fayyad, is that he was caught in an early form of sort of pre-technological phone hacking, in that he went through the bins at Private Eye. I mean, not personally. He played a man called Benji the Bin Man, who was a notorious character, early Fleet Street. And he went through the bins looking for stuff and nicking stuff outside lawyers' offices. And he went through ours. And the reason I know this is, I can say this with sort of Jane and Adam here, occasionally I have been known to write rather bad-tempered notes to contributors saying, well, that piece was a bit, you know, terrible and a bit underdone, and we've had complaints about it. And anyway, I wrote one of these letters to a contributor, and then I thought better of it. And I thought, no, I'm not going to send that. That's not fair, and that's not right. So I screwed it up and put it in my bin. Then I read in the newspapers the next day, foul-tempered, ghastly Ian Hislop, editor, writes appalling letter to staff. And I thought, yeah, I recognise the letter, but I didn't send it. And then we put a camera up outside here, and we found Benji going through our bins, and he was just giving them to Fayyad, who then printed them and then published them. He was immensely devious.
Oh, but that was a standard procedure. I mean, staff at Harrods and all his other businesses discovered that they'd had their phones tapped regularly. Recordings were played back to them at points where they were sacked. I mean, the stories that came out about employment practices at Harrods, if that's the case, that the Crown presents him as being nice to his staff, then that, I have to say, is very, very inaccurate. Because it was not only extraordinary and well-documented sexual harassment of female members of staff at Harrods, but there were also any number of executives who were fired on sort of spurious reasons. Then reported to the police for thefts and frauds and embezzlements that had never happened, and, you know, full investigations launched into them, attempts to ruin any subsequent career as well as firing them from their jobs. He was an absolute tyrant of a man, and, as you say, incredibly devious.
One mark of how much he was loved is he was fighting a libel action against Vanity Fair, which was entirely about sexual harassment of women and bad behaviour, and he'd hired as his libel QC the late George Carman, who, you know, a terrific libel lawyer who had worked for the Eye. Anyway, we invited George Carman to the Eye lunch, a traditional place for really important investigative journalism. And George admitted that he disliked Fayyad so much that he'd give us the skeleton argument.
Wow.
Which we then printed. And it was very, very poor. And I think George knew it was very, very poor and enjoyed the fact that it was very, very poor. And as it happened, the action collapsed and Vanity Fair got away with
their piece. And that was more or less his first appearance in the Eye. I had a little look in the archive. There are a couple of very, very brief mentions, but the first really substantial appearance is in about 1995, which was a couple of years after the Vanity Fair piece.
Right.
And it's a really striking rundown of, you know, all the sort of legal underpinning of what had been going on at Harrods and the
good grief,
all the
I
sexual
can't imagine
harassment.
Where we got all that.
Yeah.
The Eye's last contact with Fayyad is when our late great proprietor Peter Cook died, and the ownership of the magazine, certainly the largest part of the ownership, passed to his widow. And she wasn't as sympathetic towards the Eye as Peter. And she said that she was going to sell the magazine. She was going to sell Private Eye to Mohammed Al-Fayyad. And I was asked for a quote from the Observer. And I said, great, I'll burn the building down.
Ooh, it's listed.
Yeah.
There's fakes and nooks and corners, guys.
It'll fall down before you have a chance to burn it down. Yeah. Anyway. And so finally, we should come onto a story that wasn't in The Last Eye because it hadn't happened yet. This is something that was in The Times on Monday this week. And it's about Ben Houchen, the mayor of Teesside, who has been, what can we say? He's been sort of carrying out some researches into, you know, The Eye's written a lot about the Tees Works development programme. Mm. Richard Brooks has been on the podcast talking at great length about exactly what's been going on there, which is
it's still... about how public money is being spent in the regeneration of Teesside and the relationship, say, between the mayor and certain businessmen who've been involved in the project. And I suppose the fact that a huge amount of public money has gone in and quite a lot of money has been taken out again to private individuals, and what's the balance here? Do you see where I'm going, Andy?
Yeah, sort of interesting questions that are raised about the 90% of the shares which have been transferred to those developers and the slightly worrying paper trail that doesn't seem to be there for lots of this. Well, Ben Houchen has a really good answer to all of this, which is...
He's consulted the distinguished firm of Tucker Carl.
Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson Limited. Tucker
Carlson. He did the most amazing thing that many, many people do, of going to a very expensive firm of lawyers and saying, do I have a case here that I could spend an awful lot of money on very expensive lawyers on? But amazingly, they don't seem to think that he did in this particular case. Even Carter Ruck didn't seem to think it was a great idea for him to sue either us or the local MP, Andy McDonald, isn't it, who repeated an awful lot of what Richard had reported in Private Eye in Parliament, and therefore under privilege.
Yes, and he used, again, public money to consult London libel lawyers. I was asked by the Times about this, and I said I thought it was quite interesting that we were finally seeing some levelling up with this deprived community of London libel lawyers receiving some money that was going to be wasted on people up north. finally. But a very good piece by the Times, just getting this nugget of information out, because Carter Ruck don't tell us when they haven't decided to take action against us. They tend not to bother. But I thought the Times pointing this out was very good of them and, you know, sort of quite mischievous.
It's not a weird decision to have taken by Carter Ruck. It's a weird thing to even ask about, because councils can't sue for libel, can they? I mean,
legally, local authorities cannot sue.
So legally, they actually can't. It's not just a question of it's not the done thing. It's really...
Well, this may have been amongst... What we don't know is what Carter Ruck actually said to him. I mean, that may have been amongst the information. But the other bit of information was that what Andy McDonald said was underprivileged. So you definitely can't sue for that. So that may have been quite why they made short shrift of it. I thought they only charged him £7,000, which probably gets you about... What do you reckon?
Yeah.
Half a day of a senior partner's time at Carter Ruck?
I thought it was time we changed lawyers. Jane, that's right, though, isn't it? Local councils can't sue.
There's a ruling, I think it's called the Derbyshire ruling, because it was Derbyshire County Council that tried to take libel action and were refused. We're told by the courts that they can't spend public money on their own members or, I think, officers and councillors. Reputations.
This may be that South Teesside Development Corporation may not count as a council. He's a mayor, so that he's maybe a different status. So, I mean, there may be ways in which he can sue. I just don't want to help him out here. But the great thing about reading the Times is, you know, up at the front page it says the Tory culture secretary is going to take action about slap orders. These appalling attempts to curtail free speech by prominent individuals. And I'm thinking, well, you could look at one of your mayors, one of your peers, recently ennobled by Boris. Have a look at him, then.
Can I ask a question, which is one of those things where it's now gone too far down the road and I feel like I should have asked this a long time, which is, what is Ben Houchen's deal? Was it that he was not expected to win? He was quite a sort of poor or chancy candidate put up because they thought Labour would hold that authority? Because he seems to have been elevated to an extraordinary extent, not really commensurate with his abilities, if that's a legally safe way of saying it.
Yeah, I think he was their perfect red wall man. It was, you know, this was Redcar and Teesside and sort of Labour Steelworks heartlands. And obviously it is the former Steelworks site that is being regenerated there. So the Labour Steelworks heartland is gone. So this is the new Conservatives of the North, and he's relatively young, so I think he was good for a poster.
We have to blame the Prime Minister a bit, because Rishi Sunak, one of his great ideas was free ports. And the idea was, this is going to be a free port. And there aren't many people saying that's a great idea, Prime Minister, you know, because it isn't. To find someone who exemplified this and was going to have an exciting free port right up, in the north, for Sunak, it was a perfect mix. So I think there was a certain overexcitement ideologically there as well.
He was very popular, I think, at the top of the party. But the Freeports thing has got very little... It hasn't had much of an outing recently, the Freeport idea. Instead, we've moved on to we're going to have 100 new chessboards in parks up and down the country, which is the latest... I think that is the latest and biggest announcement that's been made, and it's...
So all those pupils who can't go to school because their schools are falling down and being closed can go and play chess in the park instead.
Just become a grandmaster in the park, and then you'll pay your way with that. Yeah, Parliament's now back. We should look to the future as we always try to do on this podcast with optimism about what's coming up next. Is there anything anyone's looking forward to in the forthcoming session?
I am looking forward to finding out how many more alleged Chinese spies there are. In fact, actually... Well, no, because this has become a really big deal. It's become... It's a huge problem in universities. So Joe Johnson has just got a report out about the fact that British universities are entirely reliant on Chinese postgraduate money. The FBI director and the head of MI6 did a joint press conference last year saying, basically, if you're a company and you get approached by some Chinese businessmen who want to partner with you, they will steal all your IP and then leave you in the lurch. Don't do it. And then now there is an alleged spy who was working very closely with Tom Tugendhat, who's been a big China skeptic. You know, he's been slagging off Ian Duncan Smith. I could have done that China for free. Don't know why you're paying someone. I think that one's got potential to get bigger and bigger.
They do seem to be getting better at the spying, don't they? I mean, a few years ago, it was Russian spies targeting, Mike Hancock, wasn't it? The MP for Portsmouth. And he said, don't go after the Lib Dems. That's not going to happen. They've got as far as the Foreign Affairs Committee now, haven't they? So, they are getting closer to the heart of power, I guess.
They started at student level, didn't they?
They've developed these things called Confucius Institutes within many British universities where you can learn Chinese language and about Chinese culture and sort of mingle with Chinese students and not learn anything at all about Taiwan or Hong Kong or the Falun Gong or any of the things that the Chinese government don't want you to know about. Things for academic freedom. It was really harmful that the education around China in the UK was so taken over by the Chinese state-funded body.
Yes, and the idea of a Freshers' Week. Come along to this stand, just sign up. We'll check your name against your relatives at home. We'll see what you're up to. We'll ask you to spy on your other students, see if they mention Hong Kong at all, as you say. I mean, it was fairly pernicious at that level, but the idea that they're doing it with SPADs is a little bit worrying. Again, we don't know yet if it's actually true. He's denying it, isn't he?
But I'm a bit surprised this is happening now because China's just assured the UK that all of the secret police stations they've been running either have been shut down or were never there in the first place. So I've got to say, I'm foxed.
Can I say he was the biggest advocate maybe in the last 10 years of British politics about being open to China? Our new podcast rival, George Osborne.
I don't think they're calling it the Osballs podcast, but they should be soon.
The rest is balls, isn't it?
George and Ed's Big Red Boxes, I think, is the... the trailer is out this week.
They're carrying boxes through the streets.
Cardboard boxes.
Implies that they've lost their jobs.
Yes.
Which is somewhat ironic, given that George Osborne is a man with more jobs, better paid than anyone else in the entire world. Where he's finding the time to record podcasts as well.
His box is actually full of things from the British Museum. Do you reckon he's just walked out with?
Yeah. Bits of Greek statuary. Yes.
That's all from us this time. Thank you very much to Helen, Adam, Jane and Ian, and to you for listening. If you would like to experience more of Private Eye, maybe in less of an audio and more of a print format, then subscriptions are available to the magazine. Just go to private-eye.co.uk and you'll be taken care of there. Thanks very much again for listening to this one, and we'll be back again in a fortnight with another. Bye-bye.